In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Oh, yes, it's time to talk movies. Alan Adams from The Main Edge joins us. Hello there, Alan. How are you on this Monday?
Hello, sir. I'm hanging in there. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, thank you. Is it raining at Shea Adams yet?
It is most certainly raining. It is loud, beating on the roof, freaking the dog out. You know, the whole shebang. And with the wind picking up tonight, I look forward to a long and sleepless evening.
Oh, thanks, dear.
Poor sweetie.
Oh, man. That's not good. Sorry to hear, too, about always tough to lose one of our friends. And your veteran cat passed away. But, man, what a long life.
Yeah, she was coming up on 20 years old, so she had a very good run. Lived most of her life down in Cherryfield with my in-laws. But 3 years ago, actually right around Thanksgiving, they came to she and her brother came to stay with us ostensibly for a month or so while my in-laws were on a cruise, and they just settled in so nicely. They just didn't really want to go back. So they became indoor city cats, and they had they've enjoyed. She certainly enjoyed the last 3 years or so of her life. She had it. She had it pretty good. And again, like for us, the big thing was she was never in any real pain. Like it just it all happened so quickly. You know, and you think what else could we do? But you know, on the other side, it's like, do you really want to put her through, you know, such a, you know, and some sort of ordeal just to get, you know, another 3-4 months of her being, you know, miserable. So, again, it turned around very quickly. You know, it was sad to say goodbye, but, I'm guessing she's doing okay wherever she is.
Oh, I have no doubt about that. Movies, what did you get to see this weekend?
Oh man, I had a good run. We've got four to talk about today.
All right, well, let's get right to it then.
Sweet. What are you in the mood for? You in the mood for a period family drama set in the South? Because we got two of those. we've got a not great HBO comedy starring Melissa McCarthy. And actually, you know what? Let's talk about this last one because I feel like. I have a hunch this is a subject that you yourself find interesting.
Okay.
So I watched we watched a documentary on HBO called The Mystery of D.B. Cooper.
Oh, yes. Hooked. You got me. Yes, indeed.
Yep. I had a hunch. one of the things I mentioned like early on in the review talking about the thing is just like, all I have to say is the name. It's D.B. Cooper. And if you know, you know. And you are clearly someone who knows. So this new documentary, it's written and directed by a guy named John Dower. It's a movie that essentially offers its viewers a potential solution to the sort of titular question.
Mm.
Or I should say, four solutions.
Yeah.
Because that's the great thing about this movie. It basically features four primary subjects, each of whom bears inside them just the unshakable belief that they know who D.B. Cooper was. and all four of them have different answers. So basically what you have is four different narrators sort of relating this story about who D.B. Cooper was, what sort of life he lived following the legendary crime. And for those who are unfamiliar, first of all, I'm sorry for you, and you know, I envy you for the fact that you're going to get to dive into this particular rabbit hole. The long and the short of it is, on November 24th, 1971, a man calling himself Dan Cooper walked into Portland International Airport, bought a ticket to Seattle with cash. He boarded the 727, took a seat, quiet, polite guy. Shortly after takeoff, he hands a note to one of the flight attendants that says he has a bomb, and he would detonate it if his demands weren't met. His demands were for $200,000 in cash and four parachutes waiting for him in Seattle. They wind up landing in Seattle. taking on the money and the parachutes, the passengers disembark. They go back into the air, ostensibly to go to Mexico City, but he doesn't wait to arrive at the destination. Lowers the stairs at the rear of the cabin at around 8 o'clock. About 15 minutes later, he jumps from the plane, 10,000 feet in the air, disappearing into the night, somewhere over the forests that are on the border of Washington and Oregon, and he was never found. So that's the basic story of D.B. Cooper, for those who are unfamiliar. These people, these four different people, tell their stories about the people in their lives that they believe to have been D.B. Cooper. You have one woman living in Florida who's convinced that her husband, who passed away, who confessed on his deathbed to being D.B. Cooper. she's convinced that he was the guy. And it turns out that the guy was a guy with secrets. Like, he had multiple identities, a secret criminal record, other things like a knee injury that he claimed was the result of jumping out of a plane. And this is great. This is a great, like, just one of those, a recurring nightmare that revolved around leaving fingerprints on an airplane. and so it's like, you hear that, and it's like, and this woman tells a story, and it's like, oh, man, this woman's husband was D.B. Cooper. And then we get to the next one, where you have this couple who owned an airfield in the Pacific Northwest, talking about how they actually know that D.B. Cooper was a woman named Barbara Dayton, a woman who was born Robert Dayton. This woman, Barbara Dayton, is believed to be the first gender reassignment surgery recipient in Washington State. Like, avid pilot, skydiver, and apparently once confided in these airfield owners that she, in fact, had been D.B. Cooper. And then there's this woman, Marla Cooper, who claims that her uncle, a gentleman by the name of L.D. Cooper, was D.B. Cooper because he disappeared in around Christmas of 1972. She kept asking her family about where he went. They were all vague responses until in 1995, her dad finally confirmed her suspicions that, yes, her uncle was in hiding and that he was the legendary hijacker. And this is a woman, like, she took and passed an FBI-administered polygraph test. Like, I mean, it's just like, and then at the end of it all, we have this guy, Richard Floyd McCoy, who is a guy who executed a nearly identical skyjacking in April of 1972, and then refused to answer questions confirming or denying his identity, his involvement in the D.B. Cooper case. And he kept escaping from prison and wound up dying in a shootout with FBI agents following his second escape in the summer of 1972. And every single one of these people are telling these stories, and you're listening to them, and you're like, man, they make a lot of sense. These are all very credible stories and credible storytellers. But that's the thing. Only one of them, at most, can be right. And so you're just watching these stories play out. And Dauer does such a great job of not, like, no, there's no implied bias. There's no judgment. Like, he lets these stories play out as they are without sort of steering us towards any one particular direction. And so, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, man, Americans, we love an outlaw and we love a mystery. And D.B. Cooper is both. And so you have this fascinating look at these people who so many years later insist on sharing this truth. And the best part of it is, like I said, only one of them at most can be right, but it's so easy to believe all of them. It's just a fantastic documentary. If you have any interest in this story, you really got to check it out.
That sounds great. I'm definitely checking that out. All right, should we go to Southern family dramas, the dueling dramas?
Yeah, we got a couple of those. We'll start with a movie called Uncle Frank. It's a new film from the folks at Amazon. It's currently streaming on Amazon Prime Video. It's the newest film written and directed by Alan Ball, I think best known to most as the creator of 6 Feet Under, the television show. But he's a very gifted filmmaker and playwright and all these things. But it's this wonderful it's set in the late 60s and early 70s. And it's this this wonderful story about a closeted man dealing with the sort of dueling juxtaposition of his very religious small town Southern family and his life living out in New York City and the sort of cultural clash between those two worlds. And it's all sort of brought to a head by the presence of his niece, a younger member of the family, who is also looking to maybe escape the bonds of small town life and winds up becoming sort of entwined in her uncle's life in a way that turns out to be both beneficial and potentially harmful to both of them. The basic gist is we're in the small town of Creekville, South Carolina. It's 1969. It's very quiet. You know, the twin pillars of family and faith, like that's the structure of the everyday. And this is the world in which the Bledsoe family lives. It's just a stacked cast. The sort of patriarch-matriarch situation, you've got Daddy Mac, played by Stephen Root.
Oh, love him.
And Mama, played by Margot Martindale. Like, they're the ones sort of overseeing the sprawling brood with kids and grandkids and whatnot. But our focus is Betty. She's played by Sophia Lillis, who was so great in the It movies, among other things. She's 13. Her dad is Mike, played by Steve Zahn, who's the younger son of Daddy Mac and Mama. He and her mom, Kitty, played by Judy Greer, they love their daughter, but they don't really get her. They don't connect with her. And the truth is, Betty doesn't really connect with anyone in her family except her Uncle Frank, played by Paul Bettany. Now, Uncle Frank is the oldest child, but he isn't around much. There's a lot of hostility towards him whenever he's around, particularly from his father, while everyone else either joins in with that hostility or basically ignores the negativity. But when he does show up, he's like the only adult in her life that actually engages with her as a person. And so that relationship inspires her to sort of reach beyond the borders of her town to become something more. So 4 years later, Betty, who's now going by Beth, arrives for her freshman year at NYU, which is the same place where Uncle Frank is a literature professor. So she winds up crashing a party at her uncle's place, and that's where she meets Wally, played by Peter McDissey. And that is her uncle's partner of over a decade. And now she finally understands the source of her family's anger, disdain for Uncle Frank. Not all of them know his secret, but those who do have sort of, for the most part, sort of poisoned the well, even for those who don't. But an emergency arises. Frank and Beth have to head back to Creeksville, but Beth's mom refuses to allow her to fly. And so they set out to drive from New York City to South Carolina, and it's an opportunity for them to sort of get to know each other a little better along the way. As you might expect, there are more than a few surprises waiting, both on the road and when they finally do arrive back home. I'm not going to spoil anything because there's a lot that goes on in the margins here, but it was a really interesting movie. It was sort of built to me as kind of a road movie, and there is that sort of road trip aspect to it. But it's more than that. Like, you've got part family drama, a part coming out story, but it really sort of avoids becoming the muddle that those sort of wide-ranging distinctions might indicate. Like, there's a lot going on here, but the fundamental truth of the story is never lost. And that truth is simple. Our families have a hold on us, whether we like it or not. And how we choose to deal with that hold is up to us, but it's there. Like, even someone like Frank, someone who has built his own family in his tight-knit New York sort of friendship, you know, group, can't help but feel connected and want that connection to be positive, even when it offers him nothing but sadness. Like, it looks great. It's the period aesthetic is very clear and specific, and not just in terms of production design. Like, the whole film is kind of reminiscent of the new Hollywood, like, films from the 1970s. It has that kind of vibe, like very character-driven storytelling. And it's really nice to see. And, you know, a movie like this, you know, always worry that it's going to get caught in the trap of focusing too much on the message at the expense of everything else. But the message remains centralized, but it never supersedes the rest of things. It's not substance over style. It's not style over substance. They really strike a nice balance. But again, the success of this movie rides on Paul Bettany's shoulders. Like, without a really fantastic performance in the titular role, like, this movie never gets off the ground. And he's great. Bettany is fantastic here. Like he's more than capable of handling the emotional heft. He's got he gives a very nuanced and vulnerable performance. Like he's got this sort of intellectual snarkiness set against that sort of inescapable othering that comes with the familial dynamic. And then you've got Sophia Lillis, who's, I think, is an incredibly gifted performer. And she's dynamite. Like she's got this wonderful positivity and this wonderful sense of naivete, this wide-eyed generosity of spirit that just sort of really captures why the connection she has to her uncle is so strong. And then you've got just the stacked supporting cast. Man, I'll tell you what, Stephen Root is always great, but I'm always really into it when he kind of subverts that sort of genial gregariousness into something dark and mean, and he really does that here. Like he's a real mean dude here, and it's great. Margot Martindale's a cinematic treasure, and so it's great to see her whenever, but she really embodies that sort of mid-century Southern housewife. Steve Zahn, Judy Greer are great, and like just everybody is just so good. There are a few bumps in the road, along the way, but for the most part, this is an emotionally impactful, it's tender, surprisingly funny journey. We all have forever connections to our families, and, we should all be lucky if those families include an Uncle Frank of our own.
There you go. And what's the other one?
So I saw Hillbilly Elegy.
Oof.
And
oof.
On Netflix.
Yeah.
Now I'm gonna say this, Rich. A lot of my critical peers have been very unkind to this movie. And one of the things that I've learned from being part of the larger critical discourse is that I generally align with the consensus view of my peers. Like, I'm not in lockstep with the crowd. We all have our differences. But a lot of the time, I'm basically in the neighborhood. But not always. And I think that's the case here. So Hillbilly Elegy, it's directed by Ron Howard. The script is written by Vanessa Taylor. It's adapted from J.D. Vance's 2016 memoir of the same name. It's the story of a young man's connection to his Kentucky roots and how those roots impact his current circumstances as a student at Yale Law. And it's been panned. Like, a lot of critics have really gone after it. The big criticism has been for it being sort of a transparent sort of awards grab that lacks in soul and substance. And honestly, I respectfully disagree with that take. Now, I'm not saying this movie's perfect, like not by any stretch. It's not great. It's not a great movie. It has its share of issues, to be sure. But honestly, I felt like it was a much better movie than the critics have given it credit for. Like, it's a story of poverty and generational impact. That at least it tries to address the emotional and economic realities that come from being poor. Like, it isn't always successful in addressing those things, but I mean, I would argue that even a misplaced effort merits a degree of credit. So you basically have two parallel storylines, one taking place in the late 1990s and one taking place in like the early 2010s. In the late 1990s, you've got young JD, played here by Owen Astolos. He's a young teenager. He and his family live in Ohio, Middletown, Ohio. But their home, the place where their roots are, is the small town of Jackson, Kentucky. And this is where he spends his summers among the people whose generational bloodlines are inextricably entangled with the hills. He lives with his single mother, Beverly, played by Amy Adams, and his older sister, Lindsay, Haley Bennett plays her. He also living on the same street, his grandmother, Mama, played by Glenn Close, who's sort of the family matriarch, and his grandfather, Papa, played by Bo Hopkins, has his own place even further down the block. And then, flash forward, we have our now-grown JD, played by Gabriel Basso here. He's a student at Yale Law, like working three jobs, trying to make ends meet, but his financial assistance is significantly less for the upcoming year, and so his only shot is to try and land a prestigious summer internship that will help him cover the costs. He's not sure he's capable of doing it, despite the constant efforts of his girlfriend, Usha, played wonderfully by Frida Pinto, to convince him that he's got what it takes. He gets a call from his sister revealing trouble back home, family trouble that she can't handle on her own, and so he has to head back to Ohio to help her, risking his own future as he ventures back. Now, we move back and forth from past to present, young JD to older JD. So we get to watch as he grows up in this family that's continuously struggling with the harsh realities of life below the poverty line. And for every step forward, there are two steps backward. And then both then and now, he's sort of confronting problems that are rooted in the long-term struggles of what it means to be poor in America. Now, look, is this movie heavy-handed? Absolutely, 100%. There's nothing subtle about this movie. But I don't think that's a bad thing, necessarily. Like, the issues that this story addresses, they don't need to be subtextual. And, I mean, God knows Ron Howard is willing to lean on an emotional button in the course of his storytelling. But, you know, it's heavy-handed because it's a heavy subject. And as far as the awards stuff, yes, one could argue that the blatant sort of baitiness of the film is an issue. It's very obvious that Netflix is positioning this one to win some hardware. And there's something extremely Oscar about the performances of Amy Adams and Glenn Close, both of whom are doing what comes at times dangerously close to poverty cosplay. sort of thing that could have very easily devolved into, like, sort of unintentional camp. But as far as I'm concerned, it never tips over that edge, though your mileage may vary. Like, the danger with a movie like this, the danger that I was fully expecting myself, is for it to turn into tourism, like a chance to rubberneck at the less fortunate.
Right.
But I don't necessarily feel like it crossed that line into what I've sort of dubbed hicksploitation. Like, there are a lot of different ways to be poor in this country. Just because this story doesn't match up with one person's perception of how poverty looks doesn't make it totally inaccurate. Then, yes, there are moments that are overwrought and melodramatic, moments where the underlying messaging is subsumed by the cinematic trappings. But I would argue that those flaws don't undercut the movie as a whole. They're just part of the package. Now, look, the conversation about this movie is going to be about Glenn Close and Amy Adams. Like, and look, like, these women both should already have Oscars. The fact that they don't is a travesty. Like, Glenn Close has been nominated 7 times without a win, and Amy Adams has 6. Like, and it's but I get it. It's a pretty obvious attempt on both their parts to alleviate that. Like, the Academy historically loves these sort of transformative performances. Like, they both really lean into the makeup and the prosthetics and all that stuff. And I don't think either one of them is digging maybe as deeply as they have in the past. They're letting those sort of trappings do some of the heavy lifting. They're good performances, but not necessarily great ones. That being said, I won't be a bit surprised if one or both wind up pulling they'll call it a lifetime achievement sort of win. The rest of the cast is really good, but, I mean, the reality is, like, this movie is about the two women at the top. Like, everyone else is holding their own, the only conversation that people are going to be having about this movie over the next few months is whether or not Glenn Close and Amy Adams are going to get their Oscars. Look, Hillbilly Elegy is not the capital I important film that it wants to be. Like, there's some total inconsistency, some overly simplistic narrative choices, kind of just keep it from ascending to the heights that it's seeking. But I don't think it's the abject disaster that so many seem eager to sort of paint it. It's a good but very flawed film that tries with varying degrees of success to explore the struggles inherent to life on the bottom of the American economic ladder. And I think whether it's entirely successful about that, like I said, your mileage may vary, but frankly, I applaud the effort.
All right. Well, Al, we are hopelessly behind, so we got to take a little break here. We'll have to hear about the fourth movie on Wednesday when we visit with you.
Yeah, we'll chat about stuff later.
All right, that sounds good. Thanks, Al. Batten down your hatches. Hopefully get some rest tonight, and we'll check in Wednesday.
Yeah, we'll do. Talk soon.